Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hello and welcome to the show. This week we speak with Gordon Felt, president of the families of Flight 93, the plane that went down in Pennsylvania on 9/11. Gordon lost his brother Edward on that flight, and he talks about the upcoming 10th anniversary of 9/11, as well as how his family is coping and the progress of the National Memorial. We also speak with our movie critic Diana Roldan on the summer that was in movies and what we can expect this fall as Academy Awards season kicks off. We also have a killer remix for you from Beyoncé.
Capture your need for sound.
It's been almost 10 years since that fateful day on September 11th, 2001, when that calm, peaceful morning was shattered by horrendous terrorist attacks that changed the world forever. And even though we as a society were shook to the bone by the events of that morning, no one felt the pain as much as people who were directly involved. Like my next guest, Mr. Gordon Felt, whose brother Edward died as a passenger on Flight 93 when it crashed violently in Pennsylvania. Gordon is president of the families of Flight 93, and I'm honored to have him join us today. Gordon, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you.
Gordon, can we start off where you were on the morning of 9/11 and how you found out that your brother Edward was in trouble?
Sure. I was driving into my camp up in central New York on the morning of September 11th, 2001. And one of my maintenance staff asked if I heard what was going on. And I didn't. And I kind of turned his radio up on his truck, and I kind of went over and listened to the beginning of what was unfolding in New York. At that point, I knew my brother was traveling, but I didn't even consider that he would be involved at all in the events. But I called my wife and I told her to kind of turn the TV on, and she actually brought the TV up to camp, and we sat and we watched the events unfold in New York and then in Washington. And I got the first call from my sister-in-law late morning on September 11th, saying that Ed, my brother, was traveling, that she hadn't heard from him, that she wasn't able to get any information out of the airlines at that point, but that she would call when she knew anything. And then it wasn't until afternoon, around 2 o'clock, when I finally got the call from her, confirming that my brother was in fact on United Flight 93, and that the plane went down, that he was lost.
I can't even imagine what went through your mind at that point. But can you describe the feelings and just what happened from there?
Well, at first it was just disbelief and just this sense of numbness. You know, already I had gone through the experience that all of us went through watching the attack unfold, in knowing that thousands, and at that point we didn't know how many thousands, but that there were thousands that lost their life in New York and in Washington. And then, as my sister-in-law Sandy was telling me about Ed, she asked me if I would go and tell my mother, who lives upstate with us. And I'd say that was probably the most difficult thing I've ever had to do, to tell my mother that her eldest son, my big brother, was gone.
In the immediate, I guess, aftermath and days following the tragedy, were you and the other families of Flight 93 properly supported by officials, you know, over what had happened?
Well, there certainly was an outpouring of support. To start with, there wasn't a lot of information that was being disclosed to us. You know, the crash site was a crime scene that the FBI had control of. We weren't able to get immediate access to that site. But when the government brought us down to Pennsylvania, brought the families down, we got wonderful support from the Red Cross, from a lot of the support agencies that were there. Then there was an organized trip for us out to the site, and there were just busloads of family members that went out and were able to overlook the site of the crash, what we now consider the sacred ground. And then as the days and weeks unfolded, more information came out, and certainly all the support that was provided to all of the people that lost loved ones, whether it was in Pennsylvania or New York or Washington, those services were available to family members.
Now, from some news reports that I've read, whether it was with regards to Flight 93 or just sort of the other planes as well, but again, specifically the one that affected your brother, it felt like as the time went on, it was a bit difficult to get, I guess, quote unquote, answers. Is that why you and the other families formed the group, the Families of Flight 93?
Well, the Families of Flight 93 were the group was founded because we saw a need to have representation related to the development of a national memorial. We felt very strongly that we wanted to have a seat at the table. And instead of 40 individual families all vying for a seat, we banded together to form an organization that we thought would have a greater impact on the events. And we became, from the very beginning, a full-fledged member of a partnership between the National Park Service, the National Park Foundation, the local community through the Friends of Flight 93, and then the families of Flight 93. So that was the original intent that we had. It was more having to do with the creation of a memorial.
Joining us on the phone right now is Gordon Felt, president of the Families of Flight 93. And please check out the website, www.honorflight93.org. Gordon, to you and your family, what has having a group like the Families of Flight 93 meant to your, I guess, emotional well-being and recovery from losing your brother in such a tragic way?
Every year as we gather out at the site for the commemorative service, I find comfort in being with the families. Having gone through this tragedy together, we share that common bond, and it's a bit easier for us to remember, and a bit easier for us to talk about our loss and our experience privately, so it's been a great comfort to me and my family over the years, certainly, and we've kind of morphed from 40 individual families into one large family of Flight 93. Over the years as we've gotten to know each other.
I actually had the opportunity to interview Maureen Santora, who is the mother of a 9/11 firefighter who passed away. And she said, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are, that, you know, she is now part of a bigger family, a family that she didn't really want to be a part of, but now she can't imagine not having. Do you feel that way as well about your co-families, I guess, of Flight 93?
I do, absolutely. You know, I think every one of us would rather not be a part of all of this and have our loved ones back, but at the same time, over the years, as we've gotten to know each other, as we've shared our losses, as we've learned about our loved ones that are missing and have, you know, were killed on September 11th, it's hard to imagine not being a part of this organization, and it's hard to imagine not knowing these others. They are like family to us now.
And with regards to the organization and these groups of families and you being president, what is your role? And I guess, again, in the grand scheme, what does the Families of Flight 93 aspire to do and continue to do now 10 years after?
Well, what we've done is we have ensured that at every stage of development of the Flight 93 National Memorial, we've had representation and had a voice to help drive the process as an equal partner. We've had family members involved in, you know, critically involved in acquiring the land on which the memorial is being built. We've had family members that were a part of the two different juries for selection of the design. We've had family members deeply involved in fundraising. We've had family members that have been involved up on Capitol Hill looking for federal appropriations, as well as working in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania for appropriations for the memorial. We've had family members deeply involved in planning each year's commemorative service, so that our organization has been very active and very proactive in this process.
Gordon, do you feel like it's been a long road to get the Flight 93 National Memorial built and then, you know, sort of funded? Like, do you think it's taken longer than it should have?
In retrospect, looking back, no. I'm amazed that we've come as far as we've come in such a short period of time. But if I look back on a day-to-day basis, it seems like it's taken forever, if that makes any sense. You know, the World War II Memorial was just completed recently, and the Martin Luther King Memorial was just completed recently. And so we've been able to do in 10 years really what's never been done before in terms of starting a memorial from the ground up. And while we haven't completed the memorial at this 10th anniversary as we dedicate the Flight 93 National Memorial. We're really dedicating the first phase of construction, so we have a ways to go still. But I am, you know, quite confident that this will be done in a timely fashion, and I am, you know, relieved that we've and pleased and proud of the fact that we've been able to get as far as we have.
And with regards to a status update on the memorial, I know they're planning to have, the big ceremony on September 10th. Can you sort of give, for people who don't know exactly what they can expect, can you sort of give us an overview about what is going to be there as of this year, the 10th anniversary?
Sure. We have two different ceremonies that will be taking place, and both ceremonies are of a very different nature. On September 10th this year, we will be dedicating the Flight 93 National Memorial, and that's the process by which this memorial is turned over to the federal government. And there will be representatives from the federal government there to receive this memorial on behalf of the people of the United States. So that is going to be a very proud, kind of bittersweet moment for us all to know that the final resting place of our loved ones will be cared for, respected, and treated with the dignity that our loved ones deserve in perpetuity. And then on September 11th this year, obviously with the 10th year milestone, we will be having a very formal, somber memorial service to the 40 passengers and crew.
And I have to ask you about that, I guess, specific part, Gordon. How does it feel to you coming up again to this 10th anniversary? Because I've always wanted to know, you know, I think the media likes to make a big deal about when it was the 5th anniversary, when it was the 1st anniversary, and now, you know, the 10th, it's all these round numbers. I'm assuming it's difficult every year. Does the 10th mean anything different, or is it still just as painful as it was on the 1st anniversary?
The 10th, the 7th, the 13th, I'm sure, you know, down the line are equally as disturbing, painful. The wound is reopened to a certain degree. The only difference this year is that the day before we will have this wonderful dedication service, which might ease our pain for this particular year.
And I have to ask you as well, you know, the crew and passengers of Flight 93 have been hailed, you know, so often as heroes, you know, pretty much since the day the attacks happened. Is that how you and the other families view your loved ones as heroes?
Absolutely. You know, thinking back, we had 40, you know, 33 passengers and 7 crew members, for a total of 40 individuals that were on that flight that morning. The passengers didn't necessarily know each other that morning. You know, the crew obviously had worked together, but in a relatively short period of time, approximately 20 minutes, those 40 people had to face the most horrific circumstances that anyone could imagine. And they had a choice to make. You know, they knew what was going on the ground. They knew what was taking place in New York. They knew what was taking place in Washington. They knew that they were part of a larger plan that day of evil being perpetrated against our country. And they had a choice to make. They could sit back and let the terrorists dictate the terms of the ending of their lives. Or, as we know, they could formulate a plan. They could talk about it. They could vote on it, which we know that they did. They could pray upon it. And then they could act. And these 40 individuals could have been any one of us, you know, getting on a flight that morning for work, for pleasure, going home, suddenly being thrust into the front of a war with terrorism. And they chose to act, and they didn't have to. And I think that's the message of hope that we want people to take with them after visiting the Flight 93 National Memorial, you know, hoping that if we were put in the same circumstances, that we could demonstrate that same level of bravery and be willing to fight for what we know is correct. And, you know, all I think about quite often, you know, above and beyond the loss of my brother, certainly, which has been devastating to my family, I can't imagine what would have happened if they chose not to fight and that plane reached its target. It was flown into the Capitol building, as the 9/11 Commission believes was the intended target. Not only would there have been the further loss of life on the ground in Washington, which would have been all the more devastating for our country, but above and beyond that, we could have lost one of the main symbols of our democracy and our freedom in the Capitol building or the White House, the other potentially the potential intended target. And the devastation that would have wrought on our country as well would have been all the more damaging.
For you being, you know, Edward's brother, Gordon, like in the immediate, again, aftermath, just again, because it's not like, you know, Edward passed away peacefully or you know, succumbed to a disease. This was like a tragic end, obviously, that no one could have foreseen. For you and your family, was there like burning questions in your mind about what had happened? Because I think a lot of us wondered, especially, you know, with regards to Flight 93, because it was the plane that fought back, if we can put it that way. Did you want to know if Edward was able to get a phone call out, or were you very, you know, sort of trying to find those answers? Like how did they know what was going on? All that sort of stuff.
Well, as the story began to unfold and we learned that there were some phone calls made from the flight, that certainly is a question that our family asked, is, you know, did my brother try to call? And in time, we learned that he did make a phone call. He dialed 911 and spoke to emergency services. We're not sure why he made that call to 911. The speculation was either he was trying to help people on the ground get a sense of where the plane was located, or in the air, the passengers and crew were trying to figure out where they were headed. So, you know, we feel that he was, you know, that was kind of one of his contributions in terms of the fighting back aspect of what took place on the flight. You know, we do have some information from the flight that was recorded in phone calls and such, although we'll never truly know exactly what took place on the flight, other than the passengers and crew fought back. In we know that while they lost their lives, they did help avert another disaster.
Gordon, if I can ask you to describe your brother and sort of what he was about as a person, because I think for a lot of us, whether, you know, we're a fellow American or Canadian like myself, you know, we get lost in the enormity of what 9/11 was. And I think that sometimes we forget that real people lost their lives. So what was your brother about?
Well, my brother was 41 years old, married, two children, two girls. He was a computer engineer who got up that morning like so many Americans and was going off to work. That day he was scheduled to fly from Newark to San Francisco on a business trip. But, you know, beyond the business side of Ed, he was a great father to his girls, a great husband, a great family man, a mentor to many people. He was a brilliant guy. He received a number of patents for the computer work that he'd done, particularly with encryption technology. But as I said, you know, those 40 passengers, they could have been any one of us. The stories of the individuals are so unique and yet so similar to stories of typical Americans. And I think that's why this memorial resonates with so many people. The fact that you know, again, it could have been, you know, any number of different people on that plane that were put in those horrific circumstances. But, you know, Ed was, I think more than anything, he would want to be remembered as a good father, a good family man.
I have to ask you as well, just because this year obviously marked the I guess, the finding and terminating, if you will, of Osama bin Laden. What did that mean for you and your family, Gordon?
Well, certainly it was the closing of a chapter. You know, something that had haunted us for years. And you know, when I first got that news late on that evening that you know, the military had caught and killed Osama bin Laden, you know, there was a sense of I guess completeness. But you know, the story is not over. And certainly, you know, let's not kid ourselves. The war on terrorism isn't finished. You know, I certainly had a sense of pride in our military. That they never gave up, that they continued to search, and finally they found their target. But that doesn't change, you know, our loss. It doesn't change, you know, the fact that you know, our lives have changed drastically since September 11th, and how we travel and how we, you know, how we look at the world. But, you know, I guess there was a certain sense of closure to a certain degree on that day.
Will you and your entire family be in Pennsylvania on September 10th and 11th this year, Gordon?
Yes, we will.
Okay. I just want to ask as well, you know, again, because I know that it's going to take, you know, lots of perseverance and funds, obviously, to continue to make this national memorial what it's, you know, supposed to be. If people want to get involved, where do they go?
Well, what we would encourage people to do would be to go to our website, that www.honorflight93.org. site. And at that site, they can learn about the individual passengers and crew. They can read about their collective actions on September 11th. They can see design of the memorial. They can see pictures of the construction and the progress that we've made, and they can also learn how they can contribute to become part of the larger family of Flight 93.
And just a final question, Gordon, what do you say to, again, people like myself and people listening who, again, are not directly affected, you know, by the events of 9/11, but obviously who has, as a society, been affected? As the years progress, what do you want us to, remember and know?
We have to remember. We can't afford to forget. We need to honor those that were lost, honor their actions, but not harbor any anger or ill will, but rather use those feelings of loss to motivate us to try to be better and to learn from the past.
Gordon, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gordon Felt, president of the Families of Flight 93. Again, for more information, www.honorflight93.org.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, it's been a little while since you and I have talked about music news. As you know, I'm a huge Janet Jackson fan. You and I have talked about that before. But I don't think I've ever mentioned that I am a massive George Michael fan. And I think a lot of people around the world consider themselves George Michael fans. He has an amazing voice. And even though he has managed to have lots of personal turmoil in his life with regards to drug addiction, it seems that he can just sort of power through it and continue to make beautiful music, even though he was off the scene for much of the 90s and into the early 2000s before he came back. But anyway, the reason I wanted to talk about George is he's sort of back in the news again, I guess, if you want to put it that way, in a positive way. He has actually launched his new tour called Symphonica, which is himself going around to prestigious, I guess, music houses around the world. Right now, he seems to be only sort of staying in Europe, but he's performing with the backing band of an orchestra. So not a traditional band that would normally be behind him, but an orchestra. And he's doing this because he says that he needed to, I guess, re-energize himself and do something different. I think his line was, "I have no interest in repeating past successes." So this tour that's going around again called Symphonica is focusing on his past hits, but obviously reworked in an orchestral type of fashion. And he's also singing covers of songs that he personally enjoys from other artists. And the tour just launched recently in Prague. And from all accounts, it was an amazing show. A lot of his fans very happy with what he's putting forth. And now he'll be traveling all throughout Europe, it seems, for the next couple of months. And hopefully for those of us over here in North America, he will make his way here as well. Now, actually, during the opening night of the performance in Prague, he sort of, I guess, shocked his fans a little bit by revealing certain things about what's been going on with him, because we haven't really heard from him in a while, even though he is fairly active on his Twitter account, and I follow him on his Twitter account, and I enjoy his updates. I think he's very funny, actually. But one thing that he sort of mentioned and apparently got emotional about is that he is no longer with his longtime boyfriend, Kenny Goss. And I think he had been with Kenny since the early 2000s, if not the late 1990s. And I guess he sort of has sort of put forth in the last couple of years that they were together. He never denied it, that they weren't together. But he announced on the opening night that he and Kenny had actually split 2.5 years ago. And he says that his love life has been more turbulent than he would like to admit. And then he actually dedicated a song to Kenny, I guess a new one that he's written, called "Where I Hope You Are." Another thing that I thought was very interesting during this performance, because I was able to sort of see some snippets of it, was that he mentioned that he was obviously a big Amy Winehouse fan. And he performed a song from her, basically, I guess, to honor her and because he loves her music. So right now, I would love for you to hear what he said about Amy, as well as the song that he performed. So I will let George explain what's going on. So here is George Michael live from Prague on The Kelly Alexander Show.
This next song, I'm very sad to sing, but I don't know how else to put this. In 30 years of making music, I was never actually in awe of anybody new that came along the British scene until this lady arrived.
And
the thought that we won't be hearing any more music from her is just too sad for words. This is called Love is a Losing Game.
Much a mess when it comes to the land of movies, and that's why we bring on our expert Concordia film student Diana Roldan to set me straight. Diana, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Well, thank you.
Diana, it's been a little bit since you and I have spoken about the movie situation going on, and I know that it's been quite the summer for movies, and as we come to the end of the season, I guess, if you want to call it that, it seems, I guess, if I sort of look over everything in a grand scope, it looks like there was a lot of sequels and prequels. What's up with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, if anything, the summer of 2011 will definitely be known as the summer of sequels and prequels. People got to, you know, visit a lot of old characters and see a lot of things going on. Just some of them that were released this year were the prequels Rise of the Planet of the Apes, X-Men First Class. Some of the sequels were Kung Fu Panda 2, The Hangover 2, Pirates of the Caribbean, which is the fourth in the series. The latest Harry Potter, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, Cars 2, Transformers, Dark Side of the Moon, Fast 5, Final Destination, Spy Kids. I mean, I can go on and on. So it's definitely kind of something that people are responding to, because the box office, while overall not doing as well as some of the other years, is doing pretty strong, and there's a lot of reasons why studios will release the sequels or prequels. In some cases, there's definitely more story to tell, such as in Harry Potter. There's definitely like the end of the whole kind of epic saga, if you will, that's been going on over 10 years. There's also a built-in audience who love the original movies and definitely want to see those characters again. And another reason is because of the rough economic climate and so much uncertainty, audiences really loved not only the escapism of the kind of big budget movies, but especially the ones that are showing the larger-than-life heroes and villains, but also the familiar characters that they enjoyed so much watching in the previous movies and, you know, made them feel so great.
With regards to all these movies, like you just mentioned, like you said, a ton of them, and I have a couple of questions about them, but I guess I want to start off with, what are your picks for the best movie this summer with regards to a sequel or a prequel?
Well, I mean, some of them definitely stand up well as their own films. Others are really, like, maybe too reliant on their predecessors. But my favorite, and I know I'm a little biased, is probably Harry Potter, The Deathly Hallows Part 2, if we're talking about just the sequels and the prequels. It's just, it was such a great way to end the films. I know some people will disagree with me, but it felt very satisfying. You know, a lot of questions were answered, and it felt really, really great. As far as maybe my worst pick of the sequels and prequels is probably The Hangover 2. I was so disappointed. Stars, you know, some of my favorite people, Ed Helms, Zach Galifianakis, Bradley Cooper, and I love the original so much, and I tried to go into it without too many expectations, but it just honestly felt like they took the blueprints from the first and just replaced the specifics. They had that same phone call to Tracy the bride from the original film. And again, as in the original film, it gets interrupted because they remember where the missing friend is at that moment. And just, I feel like they could have done a lot with it, but it just felt really rushed in order to capitalize on kind of the first film success. And in the process, they made it kind of a subpar film.
Okay, and I have to bring you back then to Harry Potter, because that was a positive experience for you.
Yes.
Now, with regards to Harry Potter, do you think, I mean, like you just said, it wrapped up the series well, I guess. Do you think a lot of people are going to be wishing there was another film coming, or do you think everyone's going to be okay with the fact, like, that was it?
I think everyone's always going to want there to be another film, because that world is just so rich and the characters are just so much that if you read the books, that's left out of the movies. So I know that there's discussion about of J.K. Rowling writing more books about specific characters and their lives, because in the books they kind of touch upon certain aspects of that. So I do believe that they're going to try to reboot it eventually and try to get these little character movies made. But, I mean, there's always going to be an audience for Harry Potter. There's so much that goes on in the 8 films that there's always going to be somebody wanting to see more and to experience more. And there's a whole backstory actually in the last book that isn't even touched upon whatsoever in any of the movies, especially in the last one. And it's such a pivotal part of the last book that I was actually really surprised that they didn't mention it. But I mean, for time's sake, they can't include everything, right?
And does that mean that, because I've been hearing about this Pottermore website, do you think a lot of questions are going to be answered there? Or do you think they're using Pottermore as a jump off point to see where people's interests are and then go forth with, like you said, other books or other movies?
Definitely a lot of questions are going to be answered there. There's been a lot of different websites like that. Like, there's, I think it's the Harry Potter Lexicon, something like that answers a lot of questions. They have timelines in terms of, you know, when characters were born, when they died, you know, when events took place. So there are those resources already. But, I mean, Pottermore, rather, is going to be really from J.K. Rowling. So you're going to have even more stuff that isn't included. Because all the other websites are just drawing things from the book or from interviews with J.K. Rowling. This is going to be from J.K. Rowling herself, so she can really delve even deeper into the whole kind of Harry Potter world. So I think definitely people are going to get, you know, their Harry Potter fix from that website, but I think studios are always going to be trying to get a couple more films out of it, because, as I said, it's such a rich world.
Joining us on the phone right now and on the show is our film critic, Concordia film student, Diana Roldan. Diana, if I bring you back as well, again, one of the films you mentioned as a sequel, I guess, or continuing on in the series, Transformers 3. What did you think about that? Especially because I know that Transformers 1 was so popular. I know a lot of people were not happy with 2, but I think 3 sort of redeemed itself. What do you say?
It definitely redeemed itself in terms of just comparing it to number 2. I thought number 2 was not a good direction for it to go in. I feel like they rushed it way too quickly, because number 1 I thought was great as a movie. Transformers was a great introduction to that kind of whole world, especially growing up watching the Transformers cartoons when I was a little kid. So I was really excited to see that whole thing, and I think the first one was so great that the second one was such a huge disappointment, when it felt like there was no plot and things just kind of went all over the place. The third one, not my favorite movie, but definitely better than the second one.
If we sort of keep in this action vein, I guess, what do you think about the Captain America, and where is that series going, and how did it sort of, you know, did the audiences like the first one?
I'm not the biggest connoisseur of kind of comic book heroes and stuff like that, so I'm not sure about the backstory for everybody, but as a movie, I thought they were really great. That and Captain America, The First Avenger, and Thor are both part of the forthcoming Avengers movie, which is coming out, I believe, next year. And I thought it was really, really great. The movies themselves were well executed, and they really are a great jumping off point to get into the Avengers. So we have, so far we've been introduced to Captain America, we have Thor, we have Robert Downey Jr. played Iron Man in that series of films, so that's going to be part of the Avengers as well. You saw Nick Fury, you know, in and out of a couple of the movies. We had Hawkeye that showed up in Thor. We had Scarlett Johansson's character, who also showed up in Iron Man, so it's kind of really great to see all these characters coming together in these different movies and then being able to come all together in the new Avengers movie, which is going to be really, really exciting.
And speaking of, again, just in that action genre, I know that's comic hero genre, but again, I think it's all sort of falls under that action umbrella. I wanted your opinion because I know just a few days ago, I'm pretty sure it's confirmed. I know it was rumor a few days ago, but I think it's confirmed that Bruce Willis has signed on again for another Die Hard movie. This will be Die Hard 5. What are your thoughts? I know that'll probably come out at some point next year or early 2013.
Yeah, that's not my favorite series of films, but I do understand it's kind of so iconic, and that character is so iconic that he played. I know the fourth one, that with Justin Long, was not my favorite of the series, definitely, but hopefully they'll have some fresh new take on it so that they can really make a great film out of it, because it's such a beloved franchise. And Bruce Willis is always going to be this great action hero that everybody wants to see, you know, saving the day. So I really hope that they do a good job with it.
Excellent. And I, you know, want to ask you before we move forward, I guess, for the summer, what was your best movie overall in all genres, whether it was a sequel, a prequel, or just, you know, a brand new movie, and also your worst pick for the summer?
My favorite would be Bridesmaids, just because it was so unexpectedly funny. I have to admit, I wasn't really looking forward to seeing it, but I went with a couple friends because they really were gung-ho about seeing it, and the characters were so genuine and hilarious at the same time. It really took a romantic comedy and really turned it on its ear. And it's definitely not for the faint of heart, but it's a must-see. And I think it's actually coming out in September on DVD, so people can check it out. And it's a fun time. Definitely not for the kids, though.
No, definitely not for the kids. Definitely not for the kids. And then worst of the summer?
Difficult to pick.
That means there was a
probably
few.
Just because I was so disappointed, probably The Hangover 2. Just because it disappointed me so much that...
Well, because you're a big Zach Galifianakis fan, so...
I love that. You know, I love Zach Galifianakis. He is one of the most hilarious people in my mind, and he takes, you know, awkward kind of comedy to a whole ridiculous other level. And I left the theater feeling just sad that they had taken something and made it... It kind of took away from the first movie almost because it was so kind of formulaic and just there was no originality, I felt, to it.
Okay, so that will take as your worst one of the summer. Now, you know, we're heading into the spring, and it's funny because as the seasons change, I think, you know, especially as we'll sort of delve into end of September, October, I think a lot of people want to start staying inside more. And I think they're sort of getting into that cocoon way of thinking. And I guess with that brings a solemnness a little bit. And again, that sort of leads into the seriousness of Academy Awards season. So what are the films that are sort of, I guess, going to be maybe up for contention, and what can we look forward to in this fall season?
Yeah, absolutely. The fall is actually typically when the studios will release films that they feel are strong Academy Award contenders. They actually do this so that the films are kind of fresh in people's minds or fresh in the minds of the Academy voters. And it's far too early to make any kind of real predictions because I haven't seen most of the movies because they haven't been released yet. But there's definitely a couple movies that we're all really excited to see, especially Drive with Ryan Gosling. There's The Ides of March, which is written and directed by George Clooney, also starring George Clooney and Ryan Gosling. There's J. Edgar, which is based on the life of J. Edgar Hoover. Clint Eastwood's directing that, and it's starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Armie Hammer, who played the Winklevoss twins in The Social Network. What else? There's Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, which is the sequel, and it's starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law, and that first movie was just so great that everyone's really excited to see the second one. There's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is based on wildly popular books and actually starring Daniel Craig. There's Young Adults, directed by Jason Reitman, who directed Up in the Air, and it's written by Juno screenwriter Diablo Cody. And there's also the British dark comedy Burke and Hare, which stars Simon Pegg, who is in Shaun of the Dead and was in Hot Fuzz, and also starring Andy Serkis, who was Gollum from Lord of the Rings.
And out of that list, which one are you looking most forward to?
Probably J. Edgar and Ides of March. J. Edgar is supposed to be a really, really great piece examining the relationship between J. Edgar Hoover and his right-hand man back from the FBI, so back, you know, a couple of decades ago, and it's a really, really interesting look. I actually got a chance to see Burke and Hare a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
And that, I thought, was hilarious from the first frame to the last. I was laughing hysterically. It's a bit of a dark comedy. It's Simon Pegg and Andy Serkis play these two best friends who are kind of don't have a lot of money, so they resort to grave robbing. That becomes illegal, so they start killing people to actually bring their money in, bring the bodies in, rather, for doctors to dissect. So there's this whole kind of crazy thing going. It's a period piece set in the 1800s, and it's just hilarious from start to finish. I absolutely loved it, and I can't wait for it to come out and everybody to see it.
And the George Clooney film, because he's got a lot of hats on that film if he's starring in it as well as, you said, directing and wrote it, right?
Yes.
So how do you feel about it?
That should be really good. Ryan Gosling is really becoming one of the it guys in Hollywood, and he's known for not only, you know, being cute and all this stuff and for being in The Notebook, but he's actually just a phenomenal actor. So I know when he did Billy was Fracture with Anthony Hopkins, I was a little disappointed at that because the movie itself wasn't great. The acting was phenomenal. So I'm expecting another kind of really great, just great film about and just the characters. And George Clooney actually plays someone who's who's in politics, and Ryan Gosling is his campaign manager. So there's this whole kind of thing of Ryan Gosling, if he's switching sides, if he's betraying him. So it's going to be really well acted and a really great piece, and I'm hoping that that it's well executed as well. But George Clooney, anything he does is really great, so I'm really excited to see it.
Joining us on the show right now, our film critic, Concordia film student, Diana Roldan. Diana, you know, again, as we sort of push through the fall and then head into the winter, what exciting, I guess, eye candy movies are out there, I guess, that some people are just, you know, chomping at the bit to see?
Well, there's actually a lot of them coming up. Some of the bigger ones are probably Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, just the fourth in the series. And yes, Tom Cruise is back as an action star. There is New Year's Eve, which is the sequel to Valentine's Day. It's kind of an ensemble cast with every actor under the sun, basically, with John Bon Jovi, Halle Berry, Robert De Niro, Hilary Swank, Ashton Kutcher, Lea Michele from Glee, Sofia Vergara from Modern Family. There's also The Adventures of Tintin, which is directed by Steven Spielberg. Another Spielberg directed is War Horse. There's also The Muppet Movie, which is written and starring Jason Segel from How I Met Your Mother. And there's also The Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn Part 1, which is coming out later in the year.
So regarding Spielberg, I know a lot of people are very excited about this upcoming Tintin movie. What's going on with that? Is it just because it's such a popular series with kids?
It is such a popular series with kids. I remember reading it when I was younger. I had little Tintin shirts, and I'm so excited to see it. It's CG, though, which is going to be a little difficult for some people to swallow, and depending on how well it's executed, it's going to either help or hinder the film. So it's going to be really fun to see where they take Tintin, because it's such a beloved character, as you said, and a lot of people are really, really looking forward to seeing it. It's been in production forever.
And Mission Impossible 4, how are we feeling about that?
I'm not the biggest fan of the Mission Impossible series, so I'm going in with, you know, no expectations, and we'll see how it goes.
Okay, and finally, I know that just the other day you saw the Glee movie, and I know a lot of people were, you know, very excited about this. So, what's your take? Are viewers of the television show going to be happy or disappointed with this movie?
Well, I'm a huge Gleek, as you know, so I went in with a fellow Gleek, and we were, you know, singing and dancing along to all the songs. It's basically just a movie about the tour and all the things that kind of happen on tour. So they show there's a lot of the most popular songs they'll play. They show a couple little backstage stuff. I really wish they would have shown more, because I thought that was really fun and really interesting. One of the fun things I thought they did was actually speak to a lot of the fans at each of the shows, and it showed how Glee has influenced their life and how it made them, you know, believe in themselves and, you know, believe they could do more things and really go after things they want and be honest with themselves and be true to who they were. So I thought it was a really good message to send, but I thought they could have used more backstage stuff with the actual stars of Glee, because I thought that was the most fun.
Okay, so on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being best, where would you put it?
A solid three.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
So before I let you go, any sort of final thoughts as we wrap up the summer of 2011 and as we head into the fall? Like for moviegoers, what do you have to say?
Well, there is so much to see, so definitely don't limit yourself to one genre or one kind of just romantic comedies or just this, that, and the other thing, and try to see as much as you can, because that's really when you get an appreciation of all the different films, is when you can see and really compare to different kind of works and different actors and different people. And I have the most fun when I go see a movie without seeing any kind of trailers or anything, and just go and see a movie that I've never seen before and really absorb myself in the characters and not be kind of swayed by the trailers or remember, you know, funny lines from the trailers. I find the trailers right now are showing way too much. And you kind of miss out on those moments on the screen. So really go out and see the movies. You know, sometimes even if it's not something that you think you would like, just take a chance. And a lot of times you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Excellent. Diana, thank you so much again for hanging out with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is our film critic, Concordia film student, Diana Roldan, again hanging out on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee, and today we're talking about waiting before jumping into a relationship. Sometimes when you've been single and looking for a long while, it can be a bit of a surprise when all of a sudden a potential partner appears, full of passion and desire to start something with you right now. After trudging through the desert of loneliness, here comes this beautiful oasis of love, inspiring the temptation to just go full steam ahead and dive right in. I totally understand that urge. None of us are immune to it, but I'd like to caution you to just wait a bit longer before you enter. See if that oasis is for real or just a mirage. Now, I'm not encouraging you to be mistrustful or negative when you meet somebody new. Just take it slow enough to get a better evaluation of who they are and whether you are compatible beyond chemistry. We live in a give-it-to-me-now society where instant gratification is expected. Heck, it's demanded. So it goes a bit against the grain when you prefer to take a laid-back approach when getting to know a romantic candidate. The person may think you're not that into them since your eagerness doesn't match theirs. They may even step it up in the pursuit to win you over, trying even harder to get your approval and commitment. That will apply even more pressure for you to make a decision. The thing is, for those of us looking for a serious relationship, we don't need the song and dance. We need to see the walk and the talk, and that will take the time it needs to take. You may have thoughts of guilt when applying the brakes on another's forward motion into your life. After all, here's someone who's interested in you, and you like them too. You're just not keen on jumping in bed right away and sharing closet space just yet. And that's absolutely normal. You shouldn't feel mean about it. I think it's rare to find two people who've fallen in love at the same time with the same intensity. Everyone has to go at a pace that's comfortable for them, and no doubt our past experiences with heartbreak will influence that. But as long as you're willing to explore new possibilities, it's absolutely in your right to be cautious. If you're feeling rushed into a relationship, don't allow that fear of missing out on a good thing force you to disregard your first instinct. Take the time that's right for you to feel secure. Now, I say this a lot, but it's true. Communication is key. If you're dating someone who keeps hitting the fast forward button, let them know that you prefer to just take things mid-tempo so that you can savor the experience of getting to know them. I'll also give you one warning. It's important that you don't sleep with them in the beginning stages, because that will throw things in a whole other level of complication. Getting intimate off the bat can cloud your judgment and will create a lot of mixed signals, so it's best to leave that until later. If things are going in the right direction, you'll get there eventually. If the person you're dealing with can't accept that, well, then maybe their priorities are not aligned with yours. Love is not something that can be rushed, nor should it be. When it's allowed to bloom in its own time, a much richer experience develops. So don't rush and don't worry. When you're ready to take that step, you'll know it.
Oh.
girl, I'm in love with you. But this ain't the honeymoon, past the infatuation phase. Right in the thick of love, at times we get sick of love. It seems like we argue every day. I know I misbehaved, and you've made your mistakes, and we both still got room left to grow. And though love sometimes hurts, I still put you first, and we'll make this thing work. But I think we should take it slow. We're just ordinary people. We don't know which way to go, 'cause we're ordinary people. Maybe we should take it slow. Take it slow. Oh, this time we'll take it slow. Take it slow. Oh, this time we'll take it slow. This ain't a movie, no. No fairy tale conclusion, y'all. It gets more confusing every day. Sometimes it's heaven sent, then we head back to hell again. We kiss, then we make up on the way. I hang up, you call. We writhe and we fall, and we feel like just walking away. As our love advances, we take second chances. Though it's not a fantasy, I still want you to stay. We're just ordinary people. We don't know which way to go, 'cause we're ordinary people. Maybe we should take it slow. Take it slow. Oh, this time we'll take it slow. Take it slow. This time we'll take.
I Never Had, remixed by Gareth Wynn on The Kelly Alexander Show. I want to thank my guests very much this week, including Diana Roldan, our film critic, as well as Gordon Felt, president of the families of Flight 93. And if I can take a moment to speak on the upcoming 10th anniversary of 9/11, I guess I would ask you not only to remember the people that passed away during those terrorist attacks, but also their family and friends, because obviously they've gone through years and years of pain and loss and suffering. But also would like you to remember the military, no matter what military it is, whether it's Canadian or American or our allies, you know, overseas. They are doing their best, and many of those soldiers have put their lives on the line and lost their lives to try to rid the world of these terrorist attacks and awful experiences that have been going on for the last decade. So I would ask you to sort of keep them in your minds as we approach the 10th anniversary of September 11th, 2001. Have a great week. Any comments or questions, kelly@kellyalexandershow.com. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.